Hello and welcome to The Property Exchange, your guide to the latest news, views and opinions in residential property, with Winkworth, with you every step of the way in the property market. Your host is writer and commentator Anne Ashworth.
And welcome to this latest episode of the Property Exchange podcast. This time, the housing market outlook for 2023. In this episode, we're focusing on what's happening now and on what lies ahead in the worlds of residential and also commercial property, down your street and in the high street. Some commentators are predicting that house prices could fall by as much as 30% under pressure from higher mortgage rates and the cost of living. But do these doom-laden forecasts take account of the shortage of property in the UK and the fact that most homeowners passed tough affordability tests when they took out a mortgage? This means they should be able to cope better with higher repayments. Also, mortgage rates are already easing and the trend seems to be downward. Many buyers have been looking for a family house for a while, but been priced out. They could decide this is the moment to pounce. Commercial property is also at the centre of some dire forecasts. But already there are signs of demand as investors see value in certain types of smaller developments. High streets continue to be reinvented. What will be the big themes of 2023? To find out what's actually going on, I'm joined by Dominic Agge, CEO of Winkworth, and by Adam Stackhouse, Winkworth's Development and Commercial Director. Right, first to you, Dominic. I'm going to quote from your most recent results statement, where you said that the market in 2023 will be underpinned by the unfulfilled needs of homeowners to move, renewed interest in London property from international buyers, and rising prices in the rentals market. Can you flesh all these views out for us, please?
Yeah, sure. Yes, so a lot's happened, obviously, Q4, and I'm pleased to say the first couple of weeks of January are very different places in the residential property market. So what I think I was trying to say with that commentary was, there was still, we sort of hit a period of obviously trauma and flux surrounding the Liz Truss mini budget. But underlying that, and what we've seen throughout the year, despite sort of increasing costs in the mortgage market, the cost of living, which was happening at a fairly steady pace, these categories were of applicants were supportive of the kind of property market. Underlyingly, they want to get on with it and they will drive subject to the conditions and being able to in terms of cost of finance, which I'm sure we'll talk about it, and another part. So I think looking at very early days this year, I would stand by that commentary. I think you're seeing where that can come from more clearly now. I mean, internationally, clearly the big one is China. It has just opened up and, you know, these people have not been travelling for many years. There is potentially a huge surge of interest from China, which has always been a big buyer of London property and investment in London, to come and travel. And part of that travel, obviously, for the wealthy is picking up global assets. So I think that's supportive of the international case in itself, aside from others. And so the wider picture is clearly that central London is a bit behind the other markets, as it was travel was locked down further than the actual, for longer, should I say, than the actual sort of domestic economy. So it was a delayed opening up to the rest of the market. And then, you know, we look at the other movers. As you say, there are the rows of people who were sadly, you know, stacked up living in rental accommodation, trying to get a house in the sort of beautiful places such as Tunbridge Wells or Bath, and they are in, you know, they are in their rented accommodation. They haven't found that house, and obviously clearly want to get out of rented accommodation where prices are rising quite rapidly, and it's difficult to find accommodation into the property market.
So I get this feeling of an awful lot of people waiting in the wings and deciding this is the moment to act. Are they going to be held back by mortgage rates?
Yeah, I think it's different market. Obviously, we've had a boom, you know, a sort of opening up boom since the pandemic. And I wouldn't say it's going to be carry on as that. I think we're in a very different marketplace. But I suppose it's perhaps best reflected by, well, 1 week. Clearly 1 week is 1 week, and the first week's data also is, you know, we're seeing that applicants are, visiting our website in that period, 27% below the same period last year, but 27% above 2019, which is amazingly bang in the middle. But it's that is the sort of picture. So 2019 being the last normalised year before, I said Boris Bounce was at the end of it, but a sort of traditional year for property market. And we're seeing the activity in terms of buying activity is well ahead of that. The mortgage market, you know, has dampened and it has affected people's affordability levels. But we're seeing that those costs reduce somewhat. There was a spike around the mini budget with costs going up hugely to sort of 6+. We're now seeing, you know, discounts, reductions in mortgage costs of, you know, 1.6%. They're coming down below 5%. You're getting into a sort of perhaps a more long-term position of cost of mortgages being between 4 and 5%, which is, you know, traditionally where they've sort of been.
Now, let's look at the different regions, starting with London. Where do you expect house prices to be towards the end of this year in the capital, in the centre, and maybe in the suburbs?
I think there will be coming on. I think there'll be less. I think property prices, there's, as we said by the stats I suppose there is a uplift versus a normal year. There's obviously a down step from last year. And there's more properties coming on the market. So I think what you'll see is there's a bit of exuberance towards the latter part of the year with people really bidding for these houses, and I think that will come off, and that's coming off by around 5%. So it's kind of bringing back some of the excesses that the sort of two-year, if you like, boom run created, rather than sort of retrenching back to before the pandemic or otherwise.
So I get the sense we're talking about almost normalisation rather than downturn. After an almost crazy period during the pandemic race for space, we're coming back to something that is above pre-pandemic levels, but more like a normal market.
I think so. It's been so long so it's been quite tricky to remember that. We looked at this year, there's some pretty positive things are surprising to the upside, just say, in terms of general news flow, and hopefully that continues. I think we're talking about interest rates peaking this year. Some of the worst of that perhaps has already been seen with the fixed rates rising on the back of the mini budgets reflecting swap rates, which obviously spiked. So we saw what it was like if interest rates shot, you know, as far as everyone feared, and now we're sort of, that's almost the peak. So it feels like we're on the downward slope, having sort of seen the scary cost, and we're now reducing to a more long-term norm, which if you were in June and you were fixing a house when the market was incredibly busy and was still in this sort of boom mode, you know, you're fixing it at 3 to 3.5%. You're now talking about fixing it at sort of 4.5%. So, and remortgaging, there's a rate I saw, you know, some of the 10% equity in remortgaging can fix their mortgage at 4.4%. So we've stepped away from the, you know, 6.5s where which were, you know, outside or stretching the stress test that came in 2014 to ensure there was this leeway in the property market, or sort of cushion to ensure it didn't have these sort of boom bust cycles. We're well within those at 4.5%, and I think you know, hopefully the news will surprise the upside, and we'll be finding ourselves a bit more of a positive year than perhaps some have anticipated.
Now, outside the capital, in the southeast, other parts of the country, are there any new hotspots emerging? Particularly the Elizabeth line, which has been a game changer for certain areas, so I understand.
Yes, I mean, the Elizabeth line is a thing of wonder. And we've obviously talked about it. It's a glorious way to get to work, and I actually go out of my way to use it now. So I'm a keen advocate of it all. I think it's a long-term structural change to infrastructure that will have repercussions that will build over a number of years. Repercussions, probably one word. Effects and positive effects that will build over a number of years. And the property markets that are now connected, you know, they are very much on people's radars. As we said, people people are investing around that line as well. So it's not just the sentiment of getting on the line. People have chosen to then build new houses around that line, invest in new businesses. So the whole effect will be one, a positive one. And I think I was saying, I mean, for me, the obvious one is I look at perhaps, because I know many friends who live there, is, you know, you look at Ealing, and Ealing's traditionally, it's got wonderfully big houses, great gardens. It's now got fantastic transport to get to Liverpool Street in sort of half an hour less. And, you know, compared to other perhaps sort of prime suburbs, it's slightly cheaper. I think it's around sort of £650 a foot versus your sort of £850 a foot of a sort of southwest zone 2 suburb. So I think markets like that, as an example of one, or clearly there are many stations along that line, and particularly at sort of the first-time buyer end, that also will be have huge benefits from it.
So take a look at the map of the Elizabeth Line, see where it's going. Take us beyond the capital and beyond the southeast. What's your sense of how things could unfold?
I think in terms of the country markets, I think it was a bit of an artificial period, I think, in terms of what happened. And it's sort of something that we'll look back on and sort of feel strange about, really, how there was such conviction that things had really changed forever, permanently, and that people were never going back to the office. I think it's sort of something that's, you know, clearly it's playing out. I mean, you look at tubes and the structures and infrastructure now, it's all busy with people, you know, going back to work, and we're reverting to norm with a bit more flexibility than we had prior to the pandemic. And that will, you know, have a bit of an effect. It's that surge to the country has abated. I think, again, you're going to a more normalised situation. I mean, I think I saw the other day, you know, there was a period in 2020 when, after the first lockdown, where Cornwall was the most searched for place on Google or property search. Now that's, and it's always obviously been London, and that has reverted to London. So it sort of shows the changing mood. I think that does mean that probably prices have grown far faster in some of these markets than they have in London. I think some of that will come off, but I think you'll still be well above where we were before the pandemic. So it just feels like we're finally moving on from some things that arose around a sort of traumatic event, and the property market is resettling to its sort of long-term trend.
If you were a buy-to-let landlord listening to this, what messages would you be getting that maybe London remains a good buy, buying a big property in the country to rent out could be a poor deal now? If you were a landlord, where would you be buying?
So I think the old rules, perhaps, are the ones I would always stick by. So, I mean, the income is better out of London on a return. If you're buying it for an investment and that's your income in your retirement, perhaps, then, you know, you can get some fantastic returns, or you can buy student rentals accommodation in a Russell Group university town, or there are, you know, your yields are far higher, but your capital growth traditionally has been lower. So that was slightly broken in the last year or so. But as I was saying, I expect it to reverse. And I think the people who hold in London, you know, part of the story is the growth and the demand as London kind of continues to fight and compete as a sort of global hub. So it depends on how you're set up and what you want to achieve out of it to where you want to invest. And I think that's probably the best advice I could offer.
We don't really know just now how deep the recession could be. If it turns out to be worse than we thought, is there any part of commercial property that could really be hard hit?
I think commercial property is very much driven investment decisions. It's a very different dynamic. And so they do behave differently to residential. It's driven by the numbers far more rather than the emotion. You'd never hold a commercial property that cost you money because the cost of finance had gone up. You would trade it because it's not an emotional thing, whereas obviously you hang on to your house. It's pretty much the most important thing to most people. So they act very differently. I think the decisions in commercial property will be based on a large part on the financing and obviously the demand for them. But it's much more of a commercial decision making that I'm sure Adam will lead us into and explain in depth.
Right, Adam, quite a lot for you to go through there. But if we could just start off by talking about the kind of developments that you look at and what is going on in that sector of the market.
Yes, thank you, Anne. Well, how I'd like to treat that question really is to examine the pipeline of development sites that we've got coming into the business over the course of 2023. There's a really obvious trend coming to the fore now where small to medium-sized businesses in zones 1 to 4 simply don't need the amount of workspace that they've traditionally held on to. I've got a recent example where a training academy in West London have moved most of their courses to an online media type proposal, and they're running their staff in occupation down from about 40 headcount to about 10. So they're relocating their business. And why this is relevant to development sites that we're working on as a business is because in many cases, these buildings are owned and have been owned for some time by the proprietors of the business. So they're talking to us, they're engaging with architects, and there are a number of very interesting schemes about to go into planning for, I would say, approximately 25 units or under in some gorgeous, very central London locations, whereby those businesses simply don't need the space anymore. So really, to support the point that Dominic has made, I think that there'll be a slightly more supply of stock in central London locations. And there'll be really a little bit more choice for people to buy in areas that perhaps they've always harboured after.
So we're talking about a slightly tired looking commercial block being turned into what? A mix of homes and some small retail units? What kind of structure are you talking about?
Well, contrary to previous planning guidelines or legislation whereby local authorities have really reinforced the need to retain some commercial use on site, we're finding that local authorities, particularly Hammersmith and Fulham at the moment, are loosening up in terms of their expectations. And the buildings that I'm referring to are not really on the high street. They're in some backwaters of central London. And what I'm seeing there is that the council are interested in obtaining commuted payments, so either under a Section 106 agreement or perhaps the SIL payments, which they can redeploy the capital back into the community. But in response to that, they're much happier to look at a 100% residential scheme with the appropriate mix of affordable housing. So I'm saying really that these small to medium-sized office semi-industrial blocks are going to go into residential in the next 12 to 18 months. And the reality is there will be very little workspace in there.
Now, for those who don't understand the word SIL, what does that mean?
It stands for Community Infrastructure Levy, and it's a payment that you will make. There are two tiers to that payment structure. It's a payment that the developer will make to the local authority to unlock the planning permission. And in many cases, that replaces some of the needs for providing affordable housing on site. And in addition to that, there's a mayoral SIL, which goes to the mayor's office, and it's for them to deploy on infrastructure and general policy matters in central London.
And then another bit of jargon, a Section 106?
Well, we call them commuted payments. It's effectively a cash sum that will be paid to the local authority, and the local authority is obliged and bound by law to deploy those funds towards relevant and positive investments in the borough, such as enhancing road and traffic arrangements or possibly investing in primary schools or much-needed doctor's surgeries.
So, actually, this sounds to me a bit like a win-win. We get more homes, we don't have tired-looking empty buildings, local authorities get some cash for the public realm and for services, and the housing shortage that has characterised our city and indeed the whole of the UK starts to be remedied.
Mostly, and yes, it feels like a win-win. There is one caveat I would employ, and that is the fact that losing workers in some of these districts will damage some of the small businesses. So you'll find that in some cases, small restaurants and coffee shops, convenience stores will not quite have the footfall that they're used to. However, great article I read the other day about the restaurant industry. If you like a restaurant and you enjoy it, then please go there, particularly in these quieter months. So I'm hopeful that buildings that move into residential will be occupied by people with a positive attitude to the community, and they will make use of those facilities on their doorsteps.
So to cite that phrase, eat out to help out.
I think that's a very good one to bring back to 2023.
A phrase for 2023. Now, the high street, anybody looking at their high street would be a bit concerned about the shops that closed towards the tail end of 2022. Is there demand for tenants to start new businesses on those sites?
Well, it's certainly not doom and gloom on the high street. I definitely wouldn't want that to come across. I think there have been some fundamental weaknesses which are starting to show themselves. We haven't really, perhaps difficult for me to get into political analysis, but we haven't really confronted the economic gloom. We haven't really sort of stared and bared down on inflation. And that means that there are certain zombie businesses on the high street that appear to be open. The lights are on. They may be surviving from a business bounce back loan or something similar. And they haven't really dealt with the fundamental issues at play. So yes, there are still a reasonable percentage of businesses on the high street that are doomed to fail. But the great thing about the high street, and I think this is borne out really by the return to the capital from both commuters and future London residents, is that new businesses will come to the fore and new ideas. And people had thinking time in lockdown. They do have resource, and there are lots of exciting new initiatives that the high street's about to present to us.
On the issue of finance, is the weakness of sterling making London and its high streets and its commercial properties attractive to international investors?
Certainly, the weakness of sterling is a useful fact of the economy to us in real estate at the moment. I wouldn't quite go as far as to suggest that it's propping up the market, but it's certainly maintaining demand at a constant. So we're kind of looking for almost a sticking plaster, really, whilst we stabilise the economy during this high inflationary period, and we also ratify our post-Brexit policy. So in many ways, I'm absolutely delighted, apart from the challenges of overseas travel, that sterling is so weak, because we found recently that just under 80% of our inquiries over the Christmas period were from people from non-sterling denominated economies. So they are looking to invest. In some cases, having interviewed some of these buyers and qualified them, they're telling us they've already bought the money over and they want to deploy it into mixed use real estate. So yes, sterling is definitely helping us, and it's helping us at a particularly challenging time.
So, Adam, when you say non-sterling buyers, whereabouts are they coming from?
Well, I'd say the most obvious trend is for dollar-denominated buyers. So that's not necessarily, as we know, from across the Atlantic, but it's from countries all over the world where they've got assets held in dollars. And in many cases, these are second or third generation investors, where previous family members, uncles, parents have invested in the UK real estate market at times when sterling is weak. And these people from further afield simply watch that data and they step forward when they see that the pound is low, because they do believe in the long term positives of London property.
How interesting. A vote of confidence in London. Dominic, we've got a budget coming up on March the 15th. Yes, another one. What do you want Jeremy Hunt to be talking about on the economy and on housing?
I think, yes, I'd like Jeremy Hunt to be not adding too much new to this his agenda, this budget. We think we've had a lot of change, and it would be good if we had some stability now. So that aside, I think the areas I'd like to see are probably reversals, which perhaps won't be the order of the day at the moment, considering the need to raise taxes to pay the bills of the government. So I think from my point of view, sort of on the economy, I think corporation tax is something that I think is undercooked as a problem. I mean, it's a big change, 19 to 25%. I think that affects all sorts. It does affect businesses moving to the UK. It does affect those living off dividends, including pensions, which are funded by dividends. So all of that is a negative at a time where there's an increased cost of things. So you're reducing the income whilst costs are increasing. Beyond that, on the property space, I have to say that the area that's of most concern, and not wishing to dwell on its negatives, but it is the buy-to-let sector and the private rental sector, which is an incredible squeeze. I think there's been policies over a number of years that have put pressure on it, reducing supply, as unfortunately landlords that have to pay to maintain their investment will sell their investment, and therefore there is just simply less available for tenants, poor tenants looking to get accommodation to start their first job or move back to town. So I think something that either momentarily or at least momentarily sort of abates that, stops that trend would be great to see. there's a huge amount of fixed rates coming up. I think a third of buy-to-let landlords are fixed rates are coming up in the next couple of years, 500,000 of them by 2022. And so we need to address that pretty urgently.
Adam, what do you want to hear the Chancellor say on the March 15th budget?
Well, the great thing about the holiday season, Anne, is you get a chance to talk to people in different age groups across all generations. And I'm going to have to echo Dominic's latter point about rising rents. It is a huge problem in the UK economy. Rents are being driven up by landlords who are being punished severely by government policy over taxation on the income that they're making. And the reality is that a large number of private landlords will leave the market and cause parts of the property market to potentially malfunction if the government doesn't immediately act on the punishing tax structure that private landlords are currently facing. They're almost encouraged to put properties into private companies rather than own them individually, which also damages the revenue stream for the government. So they need to act immediately. Landlords simply cannot continue to hold properties privately. It will undermine the private pension structure in this country, and it will force rents up and up. So they need to address it as a matter of urgency.
So we hope the Chancellor is listening. That's about it. Thank you, Dominic, and thank you, Adam, for joining us for this episode of The Property Exchange. If you're a buyer or an investor, you should now have a much better sense of what's happening and what's coming next. Do subscribe and join us for next month's podcast, where we'll be talking about the hot rental market in London and how tenants and investors should respond to these new conditions. If you want to know more, be sure to subscribe.
This has been the Property Exchange podcast. For more information, go to winkworth.co.uk or find us on Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. The producer was Tom Maddox. For more episodes, make sure to subscribe to your favourite podcast provider.